The Education Finance Task Force meeting is going to come to order. We're going to start today, and I wanted to just kind of set the table for you all. I talked to Representative Growling and Senator Bonoff about this third meeting, and sort of talking about, as we're moving forward with any kind of finance structure, looking at some of the kind of basic infrastructure that we need to have in place in an educational system that will be successful. And as we were looking at that, certainly we're looking at building capacity in many ways from the department's perspective, looking at support for our teachers as we professionally provide professional development for them, our math and science academies, and some of the other initiatives that we've got going. But recently, as I was talking with them, I had read a report that was produced by McKinsey that really kind of resonated with, I think, what we're all talking about, high teacher quality, support for leadership, our principal leadership, and certainly we're all interested in providing support for our principal institute that was started a couple of years ago. So what I asked both of my colleagues if I could do is to have a McKinsey representative go over that report today, because it's really got some wonderful information. It looked at top-performing countries in the world and what were the key components that was helping them be successful. And we also looked at, in the report also looked at Boston and New York, because they've also looked and examined their teacher quality and have put in place some things that are really showing results in their school systems, too. So it wasn't only in other countries, but also in our United States. So I'd like to bring Jennifer Reedy up to the table, and we'll start with the McKinsey report. We'll have maybe an hour to maybe first half hour for her to do the report, and then have some Q&A, some time to just discuss it, talk it over. And then we'll move into the rest of our agenda, and we'll look at some of the things we're doing in our state that really are starting to build on what the McKinsey report is saying and some of the results of some of those opportunities that we've created here in Minnesota. So, Jennifer, welcome to the committee, and we're glad to have you here.
Thank you very much. My name is Jennifer Reedy. I am a consultant with McKinsey & Company here in our Minneapolis office. McKinsey is a global management consulting firm. We have about 10,000 consultants in 80 locations around the world. And our primary occupation is working with major companies on issues of business strategy and management issues. But throughout McKinsey's history, we've always dedicated a significant amount of our time to looking at community issues. Our local offices try to give back a significant amount of their time to issues here. So locally, we do quite a bit of work, including some work with Minneapolis Public Schools, which I think will be included in the presentation later from Bernadia Johnson. Among other things, here our office supports the Itasca Project, which I mentioned primarily because that's what I have spent a good part of my last 5 years working on. It's a CEO civic initiative here in the Twin Cities. But increasingly at McKinsey, we have been dedicating time and resources to looking at some of the big global problems, at issues where we think maybe our experience can bring an interesting perspective to these issues. And this report that you're looking at is an example of that. It's an example where we felt like we were doing enough work in school systems around the world that we were starting to see some interesting things, and it prompted us to write this report. The authors of the report are Sir Michael Barber, who is in our London office, who led the reform efforts in England for Tony Blair, and then a woman named Mona Morsad of our Dubai office, who's led a lot of our work working with the governments of countries like Bahrain and Saudi Arabia, and a lot of countries that are really building an education system from scratch. And that's a unique way of looking at education. Because when you start thinking, okay, if we have a blank slate, what would we want our education system to look like? So from that, we naturally started looking around the world at the aspects of the best system to try and say, what is it? You know, what creates the magic in some countries to allow them to be successful? And that was really the genesis of this report. So I'm not one of the authors. I do work closely with both Michael and Mona and have worked on these issues. So I think I will be able to answer most all questions. If I can't answer a question, I'll defer to Commissioner Segrin, who I think knows the report better than anybody in the world at this point. And if she doesn't know, then I will find out the answer and bring it back to you all. I'll start with a troubling slide, a frustrating slide for all of us who care about education in this country. In the U.S., our spending per student has grown dramatically from the 70s to today. In fact, from 1980 to 2005, we had a 73% increase in spending per student on education. And yet, we haven't seen a significant change in scores. Frustrating for all of us. But if it's any consolation, we're not alone. We look at virtually all the developed countries around the world have dramatically increased education spending and not seen results. In fact, if you want to feel better, you can look at poor New Zealand and Australia and people who, increased their funding by 200% and actually got worse over that time. It's clear that some systems are getting dramatically better results. And that some systems, in spite of significant reform efforts, aren't making a change. So the natural inclination is to go and look at some of these countries. But you go and look and see what those countries are doing, and it's a little confusing because they defy education theory, and sometimes they even defy common sense, right? Singapore spends less for primary students than almost any other developed country. They're top always on every math and science assessment. Finland, they don't start school until they're 7, and then they barely go to school until they're 15, and yet their 15-year-olds score top in the world on the PISA examinations each year. South Korea, their student-teacher ratio average is 30 to 1, and the average of OECD countries is 17 to 1. So what my colleagues did was really try and say, okay, look, you look at any of these in isolation, it's hard to understand what the magic is. So you go to Finland and you ask them, what is it? How does it work? And they can't tell you. They don't know exactly what it is distinctive about the system that works. But maybe if we look at all of them, if we look at all the top performing systems and we look at some of the systems who are really seeing great growth, that we can find some commonalities. And we didn't look at curriculum. We didn't look at pedagogy. Right? We are not an education consulting firm. We looked at the systems. We looked at what is it about these systems that they have in common that allow them to consistently deliver great results in the classroom. In the heart of education is what goes on in a classroom between a teacher and some students. But getting the system right is ensuring that every day, all over the country, in thousands and thousands of classrooms, that is happening as well as possible. What we found seems a little bit basic at first, but in some ways is a revolutionary way of thinking about what matters in education. The first thing that high-performing school systems have in common is that they get the right people to become teachers. Right? And that matters because fundamentally, the quality of an education system cannot exceed the quality of its teachers. The second thing they do is that they develop these people into effective instructors. And that's important because fundamentally, the only way to improve outcomes is to improve education. And third, they put in place systems and targeted support to ensure that every child is able to benefit from excellent instruction. Which matters again, because the only way to reach maximum performance is for every student to perform at the highest standard. So again, seems kind of common sense, but then you think about what are some of the education reforms that don't do this, right? Decentralization of power in school districts, smaller schools, charter schools. You know, these reform efforts don't fundamentally change the instruction that happens in the classroom. And that's not, I don't mean to imply that those aren't good things to do, right? But that the reason that, for example, one charter school can be more effective than the other is fundamentally because the people who are running that charter school find the right people and train them well and create a school environment. In other words, changing the structure of a school doesn't get to the heart of education, which is the instruction, which is what's happening in the classroom. This page, this slide, this point about the importance of teachers is fundamental to all of this. There's a seminal study in Tennessee that has now been replicated in multiple school systems around the country, showing the importance of having a great teacher. So if you take two kids at the 50th percentile, and they're the same, basically the same demographic profile, you have them in schools with the same funding levels, the same technology, the same curriculum, basically everything you can control for, and you put one of them with a great teacher for 3 years, and you put one of them with a low-performing teacher for 3 years, the difference within 3 years will be 53 percentile points. It's dramatic. It's huge. And a similar, almost exact experiment in Texas, the result was 51 percentile points. I mean, this has been becoming increasingly confirmed that nothing matters more on the student achievement than the quality of the teacher. In fact, most everything else can be explained by socioeconomic status, by who their parents are, by the things that are less than our control. Of the things we have to control, teacher quality is what makes the difference. Now, I think we've all known that teachers are important, right? I mean, that's obvious. But one thing we have done in the U.S., and virtually every other country has done, every one of us, except for Austria, is the only OECD country that hasn't decreased teacher-student ratio. That we've all put an emphasis on having smaller class sizes. What the studies are finding from all these efforts around the country is that it doesn't seem to make a difference on student achievement. There are a few that show positive effects, a few that show negative effects. Most of them are showing no significant effect. And I think that one reason why this happens is because when you're hiring more teachers, you're actually having to, if you'll forgive the analogy, dig a little lower in the barrel to find more teachers. And you may not be getting teachers even of the same quality as the ones that you have. You also are able to pay teachers less in general. In fact, if we in the United States had kept student-teacher ratio the same from 1970 until today, we would be able to pay our teachers 44% more with the same amount of money. You also then spread your professional development resources further. Now, I'm a parent of a public school student, and class size matters to me, I can tell you. So this isn't saying that class size doesn't matter to everything, because if you have the choice of having a terrific teacher in the class of 25 or a terrific teacher in a class of 10, you take the class of 10, because that's going to be a better experience for the student. But fundamentally, as a system reform, it has not worked, because a great teacher will have great results in a class of varying size, and a not good teacher will have about the same results in a class of varying size. But the key is not how many teachers, it's how good they are. And once you realize the importance of teacher quality, then you can really move the needle on reform. So this chart shows basically from 1948 until 1997, achievement in Britain was flat. Completely flat, and they tried changing funding, changing governance, changing curriculum standards, changing testing, changing inspections, the role of local government, the role of national government. They tried all kinds of things, and there was no measurable impact. Starting in 1997, they focused on improving the quality of teaching in England, and the results were pretty dramatic quickly. In fact, in just 3 years, the number of students reaching the target standards in literacy rose by 10%, which is a pretty dramatic increase when you think about it as a reform for an entire country. So let's talk just for a couple minutes about each of these three findings. First, getting the right people to become teachers. In the United States, we tend to draw people into schools of education who are on the lower performing academic standards. If you look at this chart, it shows the average SAT scores of people going into various majors in college, and education is actually one of the bottom five. Something about the way we've structured our system, something about the way we've structured the schools of education, we're not drawing our top talent in. And that's not to say that there aren't some outrageously talented people who could do anything in the world going into teaching, because we all know that. We know some of those people. But in aggregate, we are drawing largely from the bottom third of our college students into schools of education. In Korea, you have to be in the top 5% of college graduates to be a teacher. In Finland, you have to be in the top 10%. To be a teacher. That dramatically changes how you think about education in the country, what it means to be a teacher, who you get, and then how seriously they take their job and develop over time. Getting the right people to become teachers requires three things, or what we see in the countries that do this well. First, developing strong processes for selecting and training teachers, and we'll talk about that a little bit more. Managing the status of the teaching profession. It needs to be something that's prestigious. And then third, paying good starting compensation. Now, salary matters. It does matter. It's hard to know how much it matters. Nobody goes into teaching for the money, and they probably won't. That's probably how you're not going to get, you're never going to get the right talent into teaching through paying, you know, the most impressive salaries you can have. However, it needs to be competitive. If the opportunity cost of becoming a teacher versus becoming any other thing that a talented college graduate has to go into is so significant, then it's really difficult to attract some of that talent in. So it does matter. And interestingly, what matters most is actually starting salary rather than how much the salary increases over time, you know, your lifetime earning potential. College graduates tend to think about what's the salary next year when I get the job. So some countries have actually been very successful in front-loading their compensation. They haven't added more to the system, but they front-load it, make it more attractive in the time when somebody's making a decision of what profession to go into, and have significant results for that. It is true that starting salaries that in the countries that do attract top talent tend to be higher as a percentage of GDP than what the U.S. pays. So it does look like in the U.S. we're behind where other countries do. It's also true that since 1979, teachers' wages have fallen 13% compared to workers with similar education and experience. In other words, every year, teaching looks a little less attractive relative to the other options for high-performing college graduates. We're looking at the process to choose our teachers. There are two options for how you, or when you select your teacher, right? One option is to screen the applicants before you train them. The other option is to screen your applicants after you train them. In the U.S., basically, we screen our applicants after we train them, right? You go into a school of education, and then when you come out, you're hired by a district, and it's largely a self-selection process into the school of education. The best performing countries actually tend to screen applicants before they get into the teacher training program, so that getting into a teaching training program is a really prestigious thing. It's a real honor to get to train to be a teacher. So one example of this, one example of a system that looks a lot like ours is Australia, right? So in Australia, for 100 people who apply to teacher education, 75% of them get offers. And so not terribly prestigious, not very hard to get into. Ultimately, 20 of them are employed as teachers. So this means a couple of things. One, it wasn't very hard to get into, so that's not very prestigious. Two, a lot of the people who went through the program didn't end up getting jobs. So that makes it a little less attractive, too, because if I'm going to go down this path and get this particular training in a profession, I'd kind of like to know that there's going to be a job waiting for me. So both of those things are real disincentives to entering the profession. The other thing I think that you can take away from this analysis is that if you think about if we had only had those 20 people to begin with, we could have spent almost four times as much money training them and really invested our teacher education resources in the people who are actually going to end up being teachers, and maybe giving them an extra year, maybe giving them an extra year as an intern, maybe paid them while they were in school to really make it attractive. You know, you would have other options for how you prepared those 20 people who end up actually being a teacher. I think another, so this is similar to how we operate now in the States. I think another little piece of evidence that suggests that the way we're screening in the States is suboptimal is the fact that there are increasing number of studies that show no performance differential between teachers who are certified and teachers who are uncertified. And in the United States, in most states, certification means you've passed through an education program, you have your master's or whatever it is. It means that you've gone through some education program that we as a state have decided, you know, will help you to be a better teacher. And evidence is amassing that suggests we're not getting that right. We're not adding a lot of value to these people who are coming through these education programs to make them better teachers, which suggests that it's time to think hard about how we are training teachers in this country. So, for contrast, in Singapore, for 100 people who apply, 20 people get in. Very prestigious. 18 of them get jobs. So they know there's a good chance of getting a job when they get in. Very prestigious professional path. You know, I think another aspect of the best screening systems, though, is that screening doesn't end when you're hired. In fact, the best ones end 2 years in or 3 years in, which you might say we sort of do with our tenure system, but in the U.S., 98% of people who are eligible for tenure get tenure. In the best system, they recognize the fact that we're not that great at predicting who's going to be a good teacher. We know some attributes that matter, right? Verbal ability seems to correlate with strong performance. There's some things that we can correlate that these attributes matter. But teaching is an art, and some people are great at it, and some people aren't as great at it. And if you can allow in your system a way of making sure that you've made the right decision in your screening process, in other words, that you're not locking yourself in for 40 years on a resume screen, you know, the best systems are able to cull out low performers quickly. If you do believe that nothing matters more to kids' achievement than the quality of the teacher, then it's in your best interest to make sure that the people, first of all, who are hired are the best that you can, but then as soon as you know that it may not be a fit, making sure that you bring in somebody else is going to be a stronger fit. So a few options for how to bring in other talent. There are alternative programs all around the country, things like Chicago Teaching Fellows, Boston has a core. You can create an alternative program and attract different people in through an alternative certification process. Some countries have been very effective at controlling through the funding. Britain, for example, kind of controls slots. They know how effective graduates have been from varying teaching universities, and their funding is based on that. They actually track back to the School of Ed. And their third way of doing it is actually a system-wide recruiting process. You know, in Minnesota, it would look like, you know, creating a Minnesota Teachers Academy, where if you're the top 10% of your graduating class, you can apply and after you graduate from college, and that's the one channel for getting into teaching, or the main channel. It would be a dramatic change, but you could imagine restructuring a system in that way. A little bit of good news from England on the ability to influence the status of teaching. England, in the late 90s, was having a real problem attracting just enough people into the profession. Nothing to do with quality. Like, they just weren't even getting enough people interested. And they started a very aggressive marketing campaign. They did bump up the salary a little bit, 10%. They created 32 alternative pathways, and they were able to dramatically increase the number of applicants from 26,000 in 1999 to up to 40,000 in 2003. But I think most interestingly, when they surveyed 25 to 35-year-olds before this process, teaching came in 92nd as the most desirable next job. By the end of 4 years, it was up to number one. that they were able, through effective marketing, marketing it as, you know, public service. This is that you are the best and the brightest. We want you because you can change the world through teaching. And it worked. And they were attracting them. So that's a, I think, an uplifting, hopeful example. The next point is, of course, developing people into effective instructors. At the level of an individual teacher, this means helping them become aware of how they need to improve, building their understanding of what they could do better, and then being motivated to make necessary improvements. And I think one of the key findings in the report is that you have to have all three. I think a lot of business folks, like myself, have jumped on the motivating people to make improvements, thinking that's enough, right? You pay them more and they'll try harder and things will happen, but it's not that. I mean, you need to have a comprehensive professional development that helps people understand how they can improve and motivates them to be there. And the motivation, I mean, when you go into a really high-performing school, some of the charter schools that are blowing people away, they're not getting paid more. The motivation comes from this incredible group consensus about the importance of what they're doing, and they're all working together towards this great goal. I mean, there are a variety of ways to motivate people, but having a way for them to be both motivated and given the tools to be able to act on that motivation are critical. And incidentally, I've done a little work trying to look at professional development in the United States this year. I can't find a single study anywhere, in any state, in any district, that shows that current professional development program is making a difference in teachers. And I think that's what you get from teachers too. When you talk to most teachers, they feel like, well, I go and sit in the classroom for a day, it doesn't really make a difference. That the most effective professional development programs tend to involve relationships, coaching. You go into a classroom and say, you know what, something you could do that's better is this. You know, it's focusing professional development resources on really making individual teachers better, depending on their individual needs. So four options highlighted in the report. Building practical skills in the initial training, putting coaches in schools to support teachers, selecting and developing effective instructional leaders, and enabling teachers to learn from each other. I'm going to try to move very quickly through these last couple slides, but I do want to spend a couple seconds on principles at least, because when the studies show that teaching is the most important factor on student achievement, the second most important factor is principles. In terms that you can quantify. The quantifiable impact of principles is significant. Beyond the quantifiable impact, the impact of principles in attracting the teachers that you want to have in your school system and retaining them is enormous. Right? Principles can build the environment for teachers to be effective, or principles can make teachers miserable. And there was a study recently trying to understand what motivated teachers to work in certain schools, and it found basically that a good principal was equivalent to $25,000 in salary. In other words, a teacher would have to be paid $25,000 more to be willing to go into a school with a lousy principal. But that's how much difference it makes in how a teacher feels about their experience. Highlight this study that in a few areas around the country, they've been focusing on moving principal to be instructional leader. So the focus of a principal's time is on instruction. When they have done that, this is an example in Jefferson County, Kentucky. The Wallace Foundation has been conducting these experiments. You change the principal's time from 30% of their time on instructional tasks to 66% of their time in instructional tasks, and the school performance gains doubled. That there really is something about making sure everybody in the school is focused on instruction. You have real leadership. I think the teaming idea is another one that's quite exciting, and it's been a cornerstone of the success in Boston. In Boston, the teachers get together regularly. They have good data that says, you know what, your kids are doing way better on fractions than mine. What are you doing differently? And they sit down and they talk about it. And it really makes a difference. And one of the quotes in the report that I think is quite nice is that when a brilliant American teacher retires, almost all the lesson plans and practices that she has developed also retire. When a Japanese teacher retires, she leaves a legacy. that we can strengthen the whole system by making sure that the best teachers are sharing what they know and sharing what they do. And the last point is really around equity. Poor schools are twice as likely to be taught by teachers with less than 3 years' experience. Clearly, these are often the students who need the great teachers the most, but there's a lot in our system that encourages great teachers to go to schools that are already great. They're better professional environments, and there are things other countries do to help make sure that there is more balance between the schools and that every student has a great teacher and a great school. Key to that is setting high expectations and then monitoring and intervening when you need to. And a lot of the best districts actually have external monitors, an outside authority who comes in and looks at schools. You know, there was a new teacher project, did a study of Chicago Public Schools recently, that between 2003 and 2006, 93% of Chicago Public Schools teachers were rated superior or excellent. You know, and 30% of the kids aren't graduating. Now, I believe that there are lots and lots and lots of excellent teachers in the Chicago Public Schools, maybe even half. But if you have a system that's telling 93% of the teachers that you're doing great and you're not getting the results that you need, there's some fundamental mismatch there. There's got to be some better way of not punishing teachers, but being able to say, look, these are the ways we need to improve. There are ways that you can improve, and you're the key to taking us where we need to go, and we're going to help you get there. So I will close with that. I will say that here in America, even, we're seeing the application of these principles with considerable success. I think Boston has become the poster child. Boston replaced 75% of their principals. Through a rigorous selection process, they created the Boston Teaching Residency Program to attract new talent. They are really focusing teacher training on teaming and using student data. They built a core of coaches to train teachers, and they started managing low performers out of the system. And the results have been really quite stunning in the American context. So with that, I'll stop and see if you have any questions.
Thank you, Jennifer. One of the things that we actually copied or borrowed from Boston was the Principal Institute. They actually had explored the National Institute for School Leaders program, which is a very comprehensive program for principals. And after talking with the commissioner there, David Driscoll, and sending some teams of people to look at their program, we decided to replicate that here in Minnesota and funded it for the first 2 years. We're hoping now we can continue that because we think that that's really a key. The other thing, Jennifer, too, you had mentioned that, maybe starting to track some of the impact on professional development, and are there any studies? I think we might have a place for you to go look. St. Francis is going to come up in a few minutes, and they're starting to actually track their program that they've created in and they've actually got a number of these key things through your report that are starting to pay off, and they're starting to see the same results. So I'll be interested to connect maybe with them afterwards to see their proposal. We'll have them in a few minutes, but we have about 20 minutes, so I'd love to entertain questions. And Terry, or Senator Bonoff, you want to?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Jennifer, could you just talk a little bit about how Massachusetts was able to do that? What was the makeup of who made that decision? What was the legislature a key factor in that? Was it working with the Department of Education? What were some of their obstacles? And what was their funding situation? Just kind of describe the environment.
I can't give a very good description of what happened in Boston. I have a very detailed case study that I can send you. I think we're finding across the country that when systems have been able to really move, they have had tended to be under mayoral control or had some kind of dramatic change where somebody is given more latitude, more authority than they would normally have. My understanding is that there was not a dramatic funding increase, but I will check on that. I can send you a case study on everything that Boston did. I'm sorry, I can't provide a better answer.
Jennifer, I can tell a little bit of the background on Boston. The Commissioner of Education in Boston and the Boston Superintendent had a pretty good close working relationship. And because of that, and the interest in improving the Boston school system, I think that they really, you know, worked pretty hand in hand. And actually, David Driscoll has been a pretty revolutionary commissioner. He established, you know, intercourse exams, et cetera, for the students, and really received a lot of flack for that, said that there'd be a lot of dropouts, et cetera. And in fact, they did a whole national public, or TV actually did a whole, PBS did a whole series on him, and, you know, looked at the whole state of Massachusetts and some of the reforms that they did. So Massachusetts has just been a very reform-minded state, much like Minnesota has. Mm-hmm. But then the Principal Institute also was used by another Massachusetts school district that was low-performing and has started to turn around. There's Boston, too, and then this has become a statewide initiative. But I was so interested in the results because the impact was really very great. And then Boston, of course, has created their teacher institute or academy also, a residency program, and also out of frustration that some of the teacher of ed colleges who are not really, you know, you listed who their teacher of ed colleges were going, well, I don't know, I never heard of those places. But they were also, you know, very frustrated with the quality of teachers that were coming out. It wasn't probably even that the program wasn't so good. It was just that, you know, just the admissions criteria of who was accepted. Again, you know, Jennifer's example of that then kind of, you know, fuels, you know, maybe, you know, at the end result is not as good as it should be. But they're interesting. And Jennifer may have gotten some more information from the audience.
Well, one point that my colleague Jill at least believes is important to make is that is around attracting principals. So having a principal academy that you guys are doing, I think, is brilliant. In fact, I spent a lot of time this year talking to people who lead programs on teaching reform, and what they do with their whole life is try and improve the quality of teaching, and they want to have great teachers. And you ask them, what's the first thing you would do to reform the system? And they say, get good principals. Even when it's at the expense of their program, because they recognize you know, that principals make the schools places where teachers can be effective. And what Jill was pointing out is that one of the things that Boston did, which I think has been critical in a number of places, is it's not just training good principals, it's giving them the power to actually make the decisions that are important to make in their district. So principals had the ability to hire their own teams, to build their own teams, and to fire when they needed to, and that made a big difference in attracting good people to be principals in the first place, because they actually had control over what is the single greatest factor in whether their school is successful or not, which is who are the teachers. But then also gave them the tools to make sure that the school was high performing.
We had a question. I think it was Representative Erickson and then Heiderkin and then also.
Thank you, Commissioner. Jennifer, to what extent have the colleges of education given you feedback in regard to this report?
I would not say we've gotten any formal feedback from, you know, like a group of college educators. I think a lot of people who are professors of education see these same issues and are concerned about them. I mean, if you're a professor of education who's concerned about reform, you are worried about trying to make these systems work. I think when I have talked to people who are from schools of education, I mean, their strong opinion is that there's room to reform the current education system. I think the increasing evidence that people who have graduated from a school of education perform in the same manner of people who have not is very troubling to them. But I think one of the things that's happening there is actually you're taking in some cases, lower caliber candidates. So the schools of education may be adding quite a bit of value to those people. They might be, but if they're bringing in candidates who are not as academically strong, maybe they're getting them up to the same level of where some people who haven't had the school of education that are more talented are performing. So then you start thinking about the possibilities of adding that value to people who are already your great performers, and you can get excited about what schools of education can really achieve.
Madam Chair. Thank you. Jennifer, do you know if those who were doing this research took a look at our cut scores that are used to provide licensure for our candidates to the Board of Teaching?
No. I don't know. I think, you know, do you mean in Minnesota or even
in Minnesota.
So there was no work done in Minnesota. It was not one of the states that was benchmarked. It was not one of the systems that was benchmarked.
Because I think the committee knows, I know the commissioner knows, we have some of the lowest cut scores in Minnesota for licensure. And it's been a great concern to me that as we moved into a different licensure, that we have not had the fortitude to raise the bar. And it seems to me that the colleges of education are hampering some of this, and it would be really, I think, beneficial to us to have those conversations and to try to work through this. And I think part of the reason that the cut scores remain low is what you have pointed out in your report, and that's that maybe in some instances we don't have the right people in the education and the candidacy track in our colleges. So I think we have a little work to do, but thank you.
You know, I mentioned that Britain is able to really kind of track the performance of education schools, and they're starting to do that in Florida here. Florida's kind of the cutting edge here to keep track of where teachers went to school and then try and track their student performance back to those schools of education. So that's sort of the cutting edge in the United States of trying to hold schools accountable. Now, we all know the difficulty of measuring performance, right? And so our inability to measure performance very well sort of undermines a lot of these efforts that we could do if we had better data. But they are trying, to bring some exposure to whether schools of ed are really delivering the high-quality teachers that we need them to.
Madam Chair, just one last thing. I did try to develop a report card for schools of education 2-3 years ago and was met with great resistance, and maybe I just didn't have the right criteria that I wanted them to submit for a report card that would be similar to our K-12 report card. But, you know, I hope that they'll seriously look at some changes now as we look at the impact of the McKenzie. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative
Hygerson. Thank you, Commissioner. Just some general comments, first of all, and you can address them. Do the other countries have the problems, or are they addressed in special ed, for example, like we are? We have school districts coming in, and the special ed cost on some of the school districts were as much as the first 6 grades combined. And I've been to Singapore, and I've been to Malaysia. I mean, there's a lot of different things they're doing over there that you know, we would not be able to do. There's also a lot of countries. We have China, for example, where they're not all required to go to school. In fact, they're kind of chosen, and they get sent to schools, and they put on a uniform and things of this sort. But again, a lot of those countries do not require all the students to be in school, go to school, and that's going to skew the numbers. The other thing is, in the United States, we have an immigration issue. Have you ever tried to get to Singapore? I've tried by plane, and I've tried by driving. Very, very difficult. They're going to hold you there for a long time.
And I've been warned about you.
But I'm just saying, I mean, you're from Singapore, and and the thing is, we have a very poor country to the south of us. And we're getting, within my district, we have Long Prairie, for example. Of the first 5 grades, 40% are Hispanic. And they're coming from a very, very poor part of Mexico. Okay? Singapore does not have that problem. Neither does Malaysia. Malaysia is doing very well. They're having the problems with the immigrant from India. Same problem we're having. But they have more of a handle on it. But again, when you start looking at all these numbers, you know, we're not playing with the same set of cards.
Well, no country's playing with the exact same set of cards, but I would definitely agree that the U.S. In general and the U.S. education system is much more heterogeneous than most other systems. So when you look at international scores, you can never really know, are we 10 points better than this one or less, because we're all different, right? So, but what I think the international benchmarking does allow you to do is highlight those that are making good progress, and then be able to take a look at them and say, you know, what are they doing better? So I would never argue with you at all about whether the U.S. is really here versus this one or this. But I don't think that necessarily, invalidates the idea that there are some truisms among the countries that are getting great results that we can benefit from. Whether we're really at 70th percentile or 90th percentile, we can get better. We know we can do better by any measure. And looking at other countries, is a pretty good way to think about options for us.
And let's unpack this, too. Some of these countries have come from, very poor educational systems, and in a very short time, in 10, 20 years, where they had very high, illiteracy rates, to, being outperforming in so many areas. So they've figured out some things to do with their system that are really important, and I think that's what you have to look at. The OECD also, I had also heard, is it Andreas Schleicher? That's his first name. From France, and he had also, I was recently at a chief state school officers meeting, they had a presentation there, and that question did come up from our chiefs too, and about the more diversity, et cetera, and the large influx of immigrants. And actually, there are some countries that have had more of an influx of immigrants than our country has, and more of a diversity of challenges, and yet they are still outperforming. So, I don't have all that, information, but that would be another interesting study. We had some really robust, interesting debates about that. But we need to keep putting it out in front of us as to, what we can do to improve. Representative Greiling is next.
Thank you, Commissioner. I know that this committee is all about financing and what does it cost for a good education. That's part of what we're talking about today, and how to fund it and how much total does it cost, and it all does come down to money in the end, as I always say. And we had the Principals Academy funded in the House bill this year until we lost almost half of our ongoing funding, and then it had to be not funded in the end, and that was probably the thing I felt personally worst about of all the things that we didn't do this year. So I'm hoping that we can get out of our deficit and fund that and some other things this year. But I'm looking at, some of the things you're proposing that I want to kind of get a handle on what they might cost and how they would be funded. And I'm not good enough with the GDP and the OECD to figure out exactly what kind of salaries you're talking about. I did note, because part of this plan is that you would pay better starting salaries, not good, not great, I think is what you said. And I noticed that it says Boston had the best salaries in the state when that was part of their plan to turn things around. What kind of starting salaries are we talking about? And then you mentioned, and I know it would be different according to the area, but say we're talking about Minnesota. And then you said part of how we could pay for this would be to raise class size, that if we'd had class sizes not come down so much in recent years, teachers would be making 44% more.
At least theoretically.
Theoretically, right, than they are right now. And so I'm assuming you're going to say pay for whatever the salary increase would be for starting teachers by raising class size, which is, one of the things we can talk about, but it seems like that's going to be a hard sell. But what kind of salaries are you talking about, and did they raise class sizes in the other cities that you're citing, or were they already large maybe in the other countries?
Well, first of all, I'd say this is not as much a prescriptive report as it is the description of what other successful systems do. So I wouldn't say that I'm recommending, any particular change in salary. But there are basically three options for raising teacher salaries, I think. One is putting more money into the system, or for making teacher salaries more competitive. One's raising, just increasing the funding that we have. The second is front-loading it, structuring compensation in a way where you're most competitive when you're trying to bring people into the system. If you look at the way we structure salaries in the education system, particularly because they tend to be pension systems, you are much more highly compensated as a 10-year teacher than you are as a 1-year teacher. You know, you can shift that. You can change the way you do benefits. You can change things even within the same cost structure and provide a more competitive package at the beginning. And the third way is this idea of having fewer teachers and paying them more. Now, those are just like the three theoretical options. All are extremely difficult politically. This wouldn't be an easy fix. In terms of the number, I don't think anybody knows what the magic number is, and there's a lot of debate about it. And one of the things I worked on this fall is actually trying to develop with the Gates Foundation a survey of the top college graduates in this country to try and understand what is that point. Because you don't want to pay any more than you have to, right? And it's hard to kind of experiment and say, okay, we're going to pay $10,000 more, we're going to pay $20,000 more, and see what happens. And we're trying to really get a handle on that because people don't know. We know that in England, when they increased it 10%, they got a 30% increase in applications. Right? That's one data point. We have a few little data points like that around the country. We know that some countries have increased their compensation hasn't made a bit of difference because apparently they were already at whatever that level was that people need to be paid. I think the magic number differs probably not only from state to state, but from district to district, maybe even from school to school. Maybe you have to pay somebody more to work at school X than at school Y if you want to attract the right people. So I'm afraid I can't give you a magic number answer except to say that based on most comparisons, the starting salary of a teacher in Minnesota and anywhere else in the U.S. is not competitive relative to the other options that a highly talented graduate has coming out of college.
One of the recent things, we just had Quality Counts come out, and they did do an analysis, and they basically looked at the GDP of a state and, you know, compared kind of like professions. And in Minnesota, we were paying our teachers 94% of the GDP for, I think it was the starting salaries. And the nationwide average was 88%, so we're higher than the nationwide average based on whatever they figured out with their Quality Counts report. But again, you know, we'll have St. Francis will talk a little bit about what they've done as far as doing some salary restructuring that is really attracting and retaining teachers, which I think will be interesting too.
And I think we can guarantee that there's not a college student in the entire state of Minnesota who's trying to get 89% of GDP for their salary.
Right.
You know, clearly much more than a benchmarking exercise. It's you know, what are the options that kids have right here?
Yeah.
And what do we need to pay them?
And really, truly, there are some, you know, districts that they've literally said that, you know, their beginning salaries are so low that, you know, they could qualify for food stamps. Now, there are other districts in the state of Minnesota, though, that are paying very robust beginning salaries. And again, because they're doing that, they're attracting, you know, a really nice pool of people that want to work in that district. So it is a strategy that is helpful. Representative Morrow, you had a question?
Oh, yeah. Thank you, Commissioner. I would like to just return to Representative Pikerkin's point. I take Commissioner Segrin's observation about immigration, but I do think when we're comparing foreign countries, we do have to at least account for what might be the special education requirements and differences. Another difference we may need to account for when comparing foreign nations is, for example, in China, a local superintendent of mine just came back from visiting schools in China, and what he reported back to me is for the high schools he visited and the one he entered a partnership with, they only take the top percentage of their grade and middle age students into the high school, and then that's the comparison base for some high school scores. So I'm not faulting you, but I'm worried about the foreign comparison. So much more taken by the Boston comparison,
yeah.
And it has nothing to do with my wife being from Boston.
I think everything you say about international comparisons is absolutely right. I will say, though, that I was talking recently with some people who are working on trying to reform education in India, and they're talking about how easy we have it here, so it's not a good comparison, because their big problem is that girls won't go to school because they don't have girls' restrooms, and the teachers aren't showing up, like, you know, 10% of the time there's no teacher in the classroom, and, you know, some pretty basic issues that we aren't having to wrestle with, so every country's got their challenges, I think.
Another couple quick observations by my Commissioner. I would like to avoid painting with a broad brush all of our teacher education programs in the state. I don't think you're saying this,
But I know, for example, in my own college where I teach when I'm not here, there is a interview process, and there is a, I'm going to use the word weeding process for folks. So I don't want to paint all of our college teaching education programs. Some of them are actually doing many of the things that you're talking about. I believe also at MSU Mankato, Dr. Mike Miller is also doing some of these steps. So I'd like to be careful about those broad claims. Third point, Representative Breiling mentioned, but I'll mention it as well. What Boston did, to be specific, was its annual spending on primary education per student is the equivalent to 26% of GDP per capita. And I'm letting Tim Strom know that I'm wondering what it might look like here in Minnesota as well. But that is a significant amount of money, and I would like them to figure out what that means for Minnesota. But my final point is also in your report, page 29, and it likens teacher training to a medical residency program. And I'd just like to make sure that folks know what that consisted of. It was a higher level master's degree qualification, 6-week summer school program, training teachers for 1 year as apprenticeships in schools. They spent 4 days a week working with teachers, 1 day a week doing coursework. In their second year, each teacher was allocated a mentor for 2.5 hours of in-class coaching each week. I, as a teacher, actually, I think there's very good things about that. I'd like to figure out what they might cost, yeah. But I think those are laudable things to mention.
And I think your point about the schools of ed is extremely well taken. And I think, you know, there are some schools of ed that are doing amazing jobs and some that aren't. And one of the tricks right now is that we can't tell the difference. And if we could have a system that we could tell, you know, who are those great performing schools of ed that are really producing teachers that have phenomenal results, let's reward them, let's grow them. You know, let's send all our teachers there. So. Representative Jaffe.
Thank you, Commissioner. And Ms. Rudy, I appreciate the presentation today, and particularly the emphasis you placed on developing the sense of the principal core. While we have had the principal academy, that's an area that I've been interested in seeing us go more aggressively in assisting principals in the transition from administrators to leaders, because I think those are two very different things, and they deserve and they require some assistance in that transition. In looking at states like, I believe it's Delaware, if I remember correctly, and Kentucky, where the Wallace Foundation that you referenced have been quite active, is some places we should be looking. But I wanted to, in a way, pick up the Heidgerken and Morrow theme of the international comparison and ask a question. It struck me when we look at your fourth slide listing the top performing school systems around the world. At least my understanding is most of those, if not all, are societies with more robust social support for students and families. And education doesn't exist in a void. Students don't come to school in a void. Those tend to be societies with more robust housing support, more robust healthcare supports, more robust social welfare supports for children and families than we have in the United States. And in fact, the last 25 years, we've been retreating on those supports. Are there studies that look not just at the performance of the school system, but the social context, and look at correlations between social supports for families and children and performance in schools by those children?
Yes, and it's addressed in this report in a very, very small way, which is just a report finding that do show that there are some school systems that seem to be able to get results better than you would have expected, mm-hmm. given the socioeconomic status of their kids. And that's really what you're looking for, right? And you know, there are some countries who manage to get those results. Now, is that result because of what's happening in the classroom, or is that result because besides what's happening in the classroom, they're also getting, you know, visits from a nurse or, you know, all these other things that you could be having? That is more difficult to isolate. So I think the point is valid. It's hard to know, you know, what is taking place because it's in the school and what's taking place because it's outside of the school, because of factors outside of the school, and that's legitimate. But there are some people who seem to be able mm-hmm. to do a little better than you would expect. And that's true I think, you know, when you look in the United States, you look at great performing schools, there are schools who are able to do better than you would expect. And even just taking that micro lens on the study, the schools that outperform schools with similar demographics and similar communities tend to do a lot of these same things, right? They tend to have great teachers, really highly motivated, focused on development.
We want to get Senator Rummel and Senator Bond up, and then at 4:15, I'm going to cut us off so we can have our guests also testify. Senator Rummel.
And this is just a quick comment, Commissioner. Thank you very much, and thank you for bringing this report to our attention. And you as commission members, probably, maybe you've already seen the document, but last week I ran across, and this is relative to Senator Bonoff's question earlier, the report from Massachusetts. They call it something to do with turnaround. I have the web link for that. Mm. It's very accessible. It's very readable. Excellent diagrams about what they did and what it cost and everything. It's all out there in a very accessible format, so I'm willing to send that link to anyone who wants it.
Yeah, please do that, Senator Ronald. That'd be great. All right, Senator Bono.
Thank you, Commissioner. One of the things that we are doing in our country, and I'm sure many of you know that, is our Teach for America program, and that program is for the very, you know, top college students. They apply to get into that program, and then they make a two-year commitment, and they teach in areas where, you know, we have a lot of difficulty, and I believe that they've been very successful with their students. I know my son who graduated from college, he was talking about his friends were trying to get into it and how difficult that was, and that you really had to be the very best student. And I'm curious whether or not we're retaining them, whether or not once they've finished their commitment, are we keeping them in the field? And just, you know, wondering if anybody does have any information about
Jennifer,
that.
Do you have
I do, actually. Well, one of our colleagues just left recently to become president of Teach for America, so not only can I answer the questions, I can send you a stack of propaganda about this guy, I think, pretty quickly. The commitment is for 2 years, and I think it's about half leave after 2 years. And I think it takes more than 2 years probably to be a great teacher. Right, so you're not getting people who are at the peak of teaching. But even the ones who leave many of them work in education-related fields. They're dedicated to education issues, and they become advocates for education throughout the country. And a lot of the reform organizations that you see around the country are actually increasingly led by CFA graduates. And the new chancellor in D.C., you know, is one of those first CFA alums that are really, you have these people who are committed to education. But about half of them do end up staying more than the 2 years. And they're very talented people who make their careers in education and have extraordinary results. There are a lot of studies about Teach for America teachers and whether they do better or worse than regular teachers. And I can show you studies that show they do better. I can show you studies they do worse. I can show you studies that they do exactly the same. So the jury's still out, clearly. But I think it was always, if you talk to Wendy Copps who founded it, it was always intended to be, in some ways, a reform program to help us understand, attract people to education, which it has attracted a whole lot of people who wouldn't go otherwise. In fact, it's more selective than Harvard to get to be in Teach for America. And I know they would love to do work in Minnesota if they could. They recruit a lot of people from Carleton and other places who would love to be working here, but instead go, to other states.
Thank you, Jennifer. We want to move on and have Superintendent Saxton and Randy Keeler. They're both from the St. Francis area, and they are participating in QCOM, Quality Compensation for Teachers, which has many of the same components that we're talking about today. And we wanted to bring them up because they have done some of these reform things that kind of go along with this report, and as an example of some things that you can do to really improve your system. So, Superintendent Saxton and Mr. Keeler, if you'd like to come up.
Good afternoon. My name is Randy Keeler. It's always a little bit frightening to sit down in a chair like this and follow someone who's talking about low-performing teachers in America and tell you that I taught ninth grade English for 34 years. I don't know. It just feels bad to admit that at this point.
Aww.
Beginning in the late 1990s in our school district, we began to think about some issues that led to our putting together a program actually before QCOMP even existed coming down, and I know some of you may have been around when we came down and talked about the idea of quality compensation for teachers and what we had in mind to do with that money. One of the things that really caused our school district to begin to think about what issues there were in education and what we needed to do about them was not only a belief that teacher quality is really important, but recognizing the fact that in our school district, maybe in some ways even more exaggerated than in the nation as a whole, there was a bubble of baby boomers about to burst out of their employment and retire. And as we looked at that, we saw that as a challenge. We also knew that when we looked at information, at that time I was negotiating on behalf of the teachers, and when we looked at information from Education Minnesota, we knew that our starting salaries were really, really crummy. We knew that our top salaries were relatively competitive in the state, and in some ways, if you're trying to recruit and retain